Lecture 8, Kierkegaard on Subjective Truth.
In this lecture, I'd like to expand on the notion of subjective truth and the sense in which it's the realm of religion, and I'll show also ethics. And I'd also like to explain the very powerful term that Kierkegaard uses that becomes essentially the name of the movement we're talking about, existence and existentialism. Kierkegaard, of course, would not have understood existentialism, and he certainly would have objected to the idea of his being a member of any movement whatsoever. Nevertheless, it is his very special notion of existence, which is later picked up in particular by the philosopher Karl Jaspers and introduced by Sartre as the key to a movement which includes Kierkegaard as its originator. Subjective truth is a complicated notion, but the first thing to say about it is it's a quite conscientious slap in the face to philosophers. For a philosopher, truth, whatever else it might be, is objective. In fact, objectivity and truth in many philosophies turn out to be pretty close to synonyms. To talk about subjectivity, on the other hand, for most philosophers, is to talk about the merely personal or the merely psychological. Going back to Plato, the distinction between knowledge and mere opinion. Subjectivity is often a put-down in philosophy, as when we say, well, that's just your subjective opinion, or that's just subjective. So putting them together, subjective truth, for most philosophers would be itself a kind of oxymoron, something that just doesn't make any sense. To understand this in Kierkegaard, I think we should understand a number of things. First of all, you have to maintain the distinction between subjectivity and objectivity. And if you're thinking of subjective truth as a funny kind of truth which is objective but not objective, then that, of course, doesn't make any sense. But if you understand subjective truth as something which is unique to, as Kierkegaard puts it, the realm of objective uncertainty, instances where there is no way of getting an objective answer to the question you're asking, then the idea of a subjective truth at least doesn't run directly opposed to the notion of objective truth. And secondly, and I think more profoundly, there's a sense in which we can understand subjective truth not in terms of something which corresponds to reality or something that can be proven in a scientific way, but subjective truth rather refers to something that we might refer to as a commitment. J.L. Austin, the great Oxford philosopher in the middle of this century, talked about performatives as opposed to descriptive utterances and talked about how language doesn't just describe the world. In other words, it's not just used for knowledge and objectivity, but language is also used to make commitments, to make promises, for example, to baptize, to do all sorts of actions. In other words, you use language not to say what is the case, but you use language to make something come into being. To say I promise is to say, in effect, it is now the case that I have an obligation to you. It's not a matter of describing something that has already taken place. So, thinking about subjective truth in this light, one might think of subjective truth as making a promise, making a commitment, and of course, most central to Kierkegaard, the leap of faith itself. Deciding to believe in something, deciding to participate in something, deciding to live your life in a certain kind of way. And the passion that accompanies this is in many ways exactly what makes it subjective. It's not just a matter of making a decision. There are senses in which, for example, scientists make decisions about which hypothesis to pursue, but it's rather the passion with which this is pursued. And that combination of commitment and passion is what I think most characterizes the idea of subjective truth. Again, Kierkegaard is not against objectivity. He puts it in its place, and as I said at the end of the last lecture, he's willing to say, all power to the sciences, but, and what follows the but, of course, is Kierkegaard's whole philosophy. In particular, God and religion are not objective. There are no proofs for God's existence. Such an attempt is, as I argued last lecture, really ludicrous. You cannot use the evidence of, say, miracles to prove God's existence, because as David Hume had argued some centuries before, basically the very idea of a miracle already presupposes an exception to the laws of science. And what Kierkegaard would certainly want to say is, we're not talking about an exception to the laws of science, but we're talking about a realm in which scientific explanation doesn't even get a foothold. There's been an enormous move in the last few centuries, and one can look at this in grand historical terms. For many years, religion dominated science, and science always had to defend itself in the court of religion. Around the 17th century, those power relations got turned upside down. And by the 18th and 19th centuries, the period of the Enlightenment and the period during which Kierkegaard is writing, religion had to defend itself in the court of science. And so what you got were arguments to show that, in fact, what the Bible says might be true scientifically. Here's a fast example. In Exodus, we read the story about Moses leading his people across the Red Sea, which miraculously parted at his command with the aid of God. That, if anything in the Old Testament is a miracle, is certainly a miracle. But meteorologists have used computer modeling to go back the appropriate amount of time. It's roughly 1000 BC. And what they have found is that there was a set of conditions operative in the Middle East at that time, such that the Red Sea may have been, in fact, at very, very low tide, almost dry. It would have been easily possible for people, especially on foot, to cross. And of course, if you try to follow them in heavy metal chariots, you would very likely sink into the sand and drown in what water was there. Well, I don't know how plausible that is, but I want to point out what it does to the religious notion of the miracle. It undermines it. By making it plausible, it no longer becomes a matter of faith. It becomes simply a matter of scientific evidence. This whole attempt at apologetics is something that Kierkegaard would utterly dismiss, because again, it mixes the subjective and the objective realms. Or to take a more recent example, which I alluded to at the end of the last lecture, to look at creation as something which must be in some way reconciled with scientific method, whether through the now standard idea of taking Genesis and interpreting the days in terms of eons, stretching the time so that evolution might have time to do its work within the context of Genesis, or creation science, which tries to use scientific methodology to prove something about the proof of Genesis. Again, it's a grand strategic mistake. Faith is faith, science is science, and the important thing is not to mix them. Faith is the realm of personal meaning. It is the realm of subjectivity. I said before that it might be simply a matter of an uninteresting contingency whether there are any Christians in the world besides oneself, because the entire meaning of being a Christian, it's not social, it's not doctrinal, but it's personal. And it has to do with the commitments you've made and where you put your passion. The idea of Christianity, as Kierkegaard understands it, is clearly in this realm, but so too, in a more problematic way, is the realm of ethics. Now, I'll talk about this at length in the next lecture, but the realm of ethics is also a matter of commitment. This is something that philosophers have often tried to resist. In fact, there was a book about 20 years ago called The Retreat to Commitment, and it was an argument for objective or absolutist ethics. There are a great many attempts in philosophy, going all the way back to the Greeks, to defend what's right and what's correct in terms of some sort of natural facts, in terms of something that can be shown scientifically. In Kierkegaard's own time, the philosophy of utilitarianism made it look as if all ethical decisions could be reduced to basically scientific, psychological decisions about what made people happy, what made them miserable, what helped them, what harmed them, and so on. But what Kierkegaard will want to say is that ethics, too, is in the realm of subjectivity, And while there might be, in a very important sense, rational rules about what's right and wrong, and he did believe in those, nevertheless, accepting the idea of being an ethical person or adopting the moral point of view, this too is going to be a subjective decision, and it's not prone to scientific proof or evidence. The notion of existence is very tightly connected with this notion of ethics, and Kierkegaard distinguishes in one of his most challenging and authoritative texts called The Concluding Unscientific Postscript. By the way, a rock band that Woody Allen once formed had that name. But the idea of the ethically existing individual as opposed to the merely objective individual. One can make this distinction in a great many ways. Today, for example, we might distinguish between the person as a medical object and the person as a person with feelings and cares and values and emotions. In Kierkegaard's time, the important distinction was responsibility and making decisions and, of course, making commitments. The idea of existing, the notion of existence, is absolutely essential to him. It has to do with taking a hold of one's life. It has to do with making decisions. It has to do with being passionate. It has to do with understanding the drama of life. Kierkegaard distinguishes between really existing and what he calls merely so-called existence. There's a sense in which everyone exists. In fact, this table, this coffee cup, they exist, but not in a very interesting sense. I exist, I hope, in a very different way. And it's not just because I'm conscious, because consciousness can easily be tranquilized into a kind of mere herd mentality, but rather, I exist because I'm passionate, because I make decisions, because I, in some sense, have taken hold of my life. And Kierkegaard makes the rather rude distinction between such people, among whom he certainly included himself, and the herd, the mob, the general run of what he called Christendom, people who, in fact, didn't make decisions, people who, in fact, just went along with the flow of the crowd, people who just did what they were supposed to do. There's a sense in which existence is a distinctively exciting notion, and that's going to be very important for everything we're going to do from now on. Kierkegaard gives a little analogy. He says, imagine a man who jumps on a stallion, and an untamed stallion, and essentially just commits himself to hanging on and trying to somehow not so much tame the stallion as just go with and stay with the stallion however it should run, jump, and so on. Very exciting prospect. Compare that to a fellow who falls asleep in a hay wagon. There's a sense in which one might talk about his also riding, or actually Kierkegaard uses the word driving. This is before cars. But the idea is that there's a sense in which he too might be called a horseman, but he's asleep. He just goes where the horse wants to take him. There's no excitement. And if you want to talk about commitment at all, it's just kind of minimal commitment to stay in the seat and not fall over while the horse is doing what it's doing. That's the way most people live, Kierkegaard says. Most people are asleep at the wheel. Most people just do what the crowd has them do. They do what they're supposed to do. What they don't do is they don't take a risk. They don't take chances. Again, that idea that you should find a truth for which I can live and die. It's finding that stallion, which for Kierkegaard, of course, was religion. Or think of it in a different way. There's a sense in which the question, how should I live, has to be answered in terms of one's own propensities and one's own psychological subjectivity. Now, talking about risk might sound a little grandiose for a man whose most dramatic gesture during his lifetime was breaking off his engagement. But, of course, as always with Kierkegaard, what we're talking about is inwardness. What we're talking about is how a person lives emotionally and taking emotional risks. He says over and over again that whether one really exists, whether one is really or not a true Christian, is something that can't be, and in a way it doesn't matter whether it is discernible from the outside. What counts is inwardness. Kierkegaard takes the hallmark of subjectivity to be feelings. Now, there's a complication here, and something we're going to have to deal with several times in these lectures. And that is, on the one hand, talking about feelings, emotions, passions, which we typically think of in terms of their involuntariness, they're just happening to us, which in general we think of things that take over us. But on the other hand, the key to subjectivity for Kierkegaard is commitment, where commitment is clearly and straightforwardly something we must do and take upon ourselves. So to talk about passionate commitment might easily be construed by many philosophers as a kind of contradiction. The idea of feeling very strongly about something inside and committing yourself to something absolutely on the inside, but not showing it, not showing good evidence, first of all, in one's expressions and gestures and so on, but more importantly from one's actions, is something that many philosophers would reject. That they would say, to be passionate is to take vigorous action. But for Kierkegaard, the most powerful passions are precisely those that seem to involve no action as such at all. Now, to resolve this particular paradox, there are a number of steps one can take. The one I'd like to take is perhaps the most radical one, and I think it's pretty central to a great many of these philosophers. And I'll say it rather bluntly to begin with, but it's the idea that our passions, our emotions in general, not necessarily all feelings, but these are much more within the sense of our control and much more prone to our decisions than philosophers and psychologists and common sense often make them out to be. That when you fall in love, for example, and again, that phrase, falling in love, something which really sounds like something that happens to you, like falling in a hole. When you fall in love, I would argue that a good part of that is making a sequence of very important decisions, starting with the decision perhaps to act on what you might interpret as the chemistry you have with someone else, to deciding whether or not to pursue a relationship from one date to another, deciding whether or not to kiss, deciding whether or not to say, I love you. In general, I think one can say that while there certainly is a kind of involuntary aspect to passion, to emotion, there is a lot more by way of commitment and choice than philosophers in general have often suggested. Kierkegaard, I think, can resolve this seeming contradiction between commitment on the one hand and passion on the other by accepting some such notion. And when he talks about passionately throwing oneself into a way of life, when he talks about making a passionate leap of faith, part of what he's talking about is the idea of making commitments such that one is choosing the passions and emotions that come along with them. Kierkegaard's own choice, of course, in terms of making a choice, a commitment, taking charge of his life, was Christianity. But think about it. There's a sense in which no one can prove to you that Christianity is the truth about the world or the true religion. What you have to do is yourself learn just enough about it and, more importantly, know enough about yourself to be able to make that choice. Once you make that choice, then you'll find that the passions come along with it. The paradoxes of Christianity, for example, help provoke that passion. You decide to be a Christian, and you go to church, or you talk to people, or, for Kierkegaard, really you can just sit at home and read the Bible very carefully and very sincerely. Trying to cope with the various incomprehensibilities and paradoxes that you meet there, that's what provokes the passion. Again, if it were simple common sense, you'd read it and put it aside. But what is most provocative about the Bible, it's not so much the miracles and it's not so much the narrative, but Kierkegaard would say it is the overwhelming incomprehensibility and at the same time the overwhelming importance of what you're reading. So the idea is that first you commit yourself, and the commitment might at first be simply a step. But once you've made that step, what you find is you encounter situations, or in the case of the Bible, you encounter passages, which are going to provoke you and challenge you. And that's going to require another step, another choice. And what you'll find is as you continue to make these steps, make these choices, fight these obstacles, you're going to find that after a while you are deeply committed. The idea of a leap of faith, while it's a wonderful phrase, in a way it doesn't capture all of what Kierkegaard wants to get at here, because it might not be simply a jump, a leap, all at once. But many times, take falling in love again as an example, it is simply a step-by-step process, and at the end of quite a number of steps, what you find is you have wholeheartedly committed yourself, even if at no point in the chain of decisions did you ever think that that's what you were doing. There's a sense in which making these decisions and having these passions may not be evident to anyone else. And I've said that quite a few times. Let me make a little more plausible that very notion. If the emotion in question is perhaps rage, William James is certainly right when he tells us that it is impossible to think of someone in a rage without at the same time imagining them prone to vigorous action. But if the emotion in question is faith, what action is it that's relevant? Now, there are some very unusual instances in which action may be obligatory, and I'll talk about those in the next lecture. But in general, the idea that in faith one is, as James would put it, moved to vigorous action, doesn't make a lot of sense. The same might be said of love. The idea of love moving you to vigorous action, and let's leave aside sort of some rather untoward suggestions, but you can love someone with all your heart, and this may never be discernible to them or to anyone else. And of course, this also emphasizes the importance of the personal nature of all of these choices and passions. There was an example in Camus that we mentioned just before we finished with him. An example that comes from Myth of Sisyphus, where a man is talking in a phone booth, and he is arguing or yelling or making gestures, and he strikes us, as Camus puts it, as absurd. Well, Kierkegaard actually anticipates him with the same notion, the idea of people from the outside appearing absurd. He gives the example of making love. And again, let me say that making love here doesn't refer to having sex as it does today, but rather just to courting rituals of the sort that were very familiar up until roughly the 1960s. And Kierkegaard says, you see another couple engaged in making love, and it's absurd. It's ridiculous. It doesn't mean anything. And that's because you're not part of it. Well, so too in religion. If what you do is basically take on a spectator's view, for example, you go to church and you listen to the prayers and you kind of see what's going on and you see that there's a God and come to believe that the religion is a true one, there's a sense in which that's absurd. It doesn't mean anything in itself. The fact that you're acting along with other people and doing what you're supposed to, that's not what it's all about. But having faith, that's something very different. The problem with organized religion is that what it does is it transfers what in fact is a very personal experience to something which is at its very heart, something which is purely institutional. Now, of course, in this one can see Kierkegaard's Protestantism reacting against essentially Catholicism, something which was a very common move of the day. But also he wants to move against Lutheranism itself, which, as far as he was concerned, had become much too herd-like, much too organized. And for all of its talk about the inner spirit and the emphasis on individual freedom, nevertheless, it was still much too impersonal, much too social for his tastes. He at one point talks about the monastery. And while one thinks about him in reaction against a certain aspect of Catholicism, in another sense, he wants to say there was something that Catholicism had right, which Lutheranism has abandoned. Martin Luther often gets credit for, as Kierkegaard puts it, breaking us out of the monastery. What Kierkegaard says is he wants to break back in, that there's a sense in which the monastic life, the life in which one is devoted wholly to God, in which such questions about marriage and career, as he faced, don't arise. In a way, that is the ideal Christian life. At the same time, he wants to say there's no correct form of Christianity, and because he so de-emphasizes ritual and social institutions, there is no true church, There is no correct way to behave, but it remains completely within. It's the religious person himself who must decide what kind of religion is suitable for him. I mentioned before that when Kierkegaard talks about religion and uses that general term, he almost always means Christianity and Lutheranism in particular. But I think it's very important to say that most everything that he says could be translated pretty easily into almost any other religion you like. What's important is that it must not pretend to a kind of objectivity. It must have subjective forms. It must have some sense in which one must make a leap, or at least a series of choices, to accept it. It can't simply be a tribal religion in the sense of a religion which you belong to just because you're a member of the tribe. But nevertheless, I think, for example, of Buddhism as a fairly radical example. And it seems to me what Kierkegaard is saying about the religious life and religious choices can be very readily translated into something like a Buddhist ethic as well. Or going even further afield, in China, if you look at a religion like Taoism, not so much Confucianism, but Taoism certainly, I think one can make a fairly clear argument that committing yourself and committing yourself possibly step by step through your choices and passionately throwing yourself into the religion is exactly the way it should go. In fact, I have friends who have converted to Buddhism and to Taoism, and as I now retrace their steps in my mind, I can see that what they were doing was following a very Kierkegaardian recipe. They felt this enormous subjective hunger for something which they usually called spirituality. They didn't find it in their native religion. They had read some Buddhism, read some Taoism, were fascinated by it. That, of course, in itself was not yet a choice or a commitment, except in a very minor way. But when they, for example, would go to join a monastery, or when they would actually undertake a long series of ritual transformations, what they were doing was, in effect, making just that leap of faith that Kierkegaard talks about. But under what circumstances should you make such a choice? And of course, as soon as I use the word should, I've kind of undermined my own point, because Kierkegaard wants to say there's never a should about this, much less an objective ought. The idea is that people have needs, and these needs vary. Kierkegaard doesn't speculate very much about where the needs come from, although in his case, I think we can fairly safely say it comes from his upbringing, from his rather neurotic father, from the sense of enormous guilt and this sense of inadequacy that he got as a young man. It has to do with his unhappiness and the idea that he was keen not on becoming a happy person, something he tried and found was not for him, but rather his being so keen to find a truth for which he can live and die, his being so keen to find something that he could wholly devote himself to. Well, suppose you're not like Kierkegaard, and most of us are not. What does he have to say to us? Well, you could just read the whole thing as rather complicated autobiography in some rather fancy philosophical language, but I think that would be to misunderstand it thoroughly. Kierkegaard writes in a remarkably varied way. Some of his philosophy is, in fact, almost a parody of the Hegelian form with all the Hegelian language and its obscurity. Much of his philosophy, especially the stuff that he writes just for himself, is aphoristic. It's very simple. It's almost like little sayings and reminders about how one should live one's life. But the idea is that as we read this stuff, and as we become more and more moved, as good readers always are, by the emotions of the author, what we find is that we become seduced. And that's a language that Kierkegaard takes very seriously. You can't argue someone into religion. You can't argue someone into existence. But what you can do is you can provide them with enough of the sensibility so that what you do is you get them of their own volition to come along with you. That's what seduction's all about. And what Kierkegaard is doing to us is, as Clemence does to us in The Fall, he's seducing us into joining him in his way of thinking.